Okay, everybody, it is time to start, so let's come to order so that you don't disturb anybody around you. That's really nice. This is Bio 241, and let's look at the schedule. Today is the 17th, our last lecture on nervous system. Okay, and that is Chapter 7. Sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. All right, the other thing I noticed on the schedule, I'll put that clock away. The other thing I noticed on the schedule is that we have one more lecture this week, and then a week from today, exam number 2 on chapter 4, 5, 7, and 9. 4, 5, 7, and 9. So when we're done with 7, which is nervous system, we'll talk about autonomic nervous system. So you just got to go and review your anatomy of autonomic nervous system, because it's not as straightforward as you think, because how many divisions are there? There are 2, right? And along those same lines, how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ for autonomic outflow pathway? Okay, usually it's 1, except for autonomic nervous system. It's 2, yeah. So remember, 2 divisions in the autonomic nervous system takes 2 motor neurons to get a signal out of the CNS, as opposed to a somatic motor pathway, only 1. Like to a skeletal muscle is only 1. Yeah, so you got to go back. You got to go back and look at that stuff so that it's not too complicated by next time. All right. Anybody have a question on the schedule at all? No? Pretty good? Okay. So last time we were talking about ligand-gated channels. And so now that's 2 different kinds of channels that we have looked at. One, what was the first one that we looked at? Voltage-gated channels. These are channels that change the permeability to sodium or potassium when the voltage across the membrane changes. All right, and that's why we always say that depolarization is excitatory, because it opens voltage-gated sodium channels. Sodium rushes inside the cell, causing more depolarization, causing more voltage-gated sodium channels to open up, etc., etc., and you're familiar with that action potential. And where do we have those voltage-gated channels? Okay, yeah, nodes of Ranvier. And what part of a neuron do you find a node of Ranvier? On axon, that's right. So any place on an axon that's not myelinated, you're going to have these voltage-gated channels. That can produce action potentials, right? You got to have voltage-gated channels to have an action potential. So here we have a different beast, ligand-gated channel. Ligand-gated channels don't produce action potentials. All right, what kind of potentials do they produce, though? Graded potentials, that's right. Graded potentials have a whole different characteristic. They can be excitatory, they can cause depolarization, or they could cause hyperpolarization. If they're hyperpolarizing, then that kind of polarization inhibits the cell, or inhibits the production of an action potential. All right, so we don't have ligand-gated channels on axons. Where do we have ligand-gated channels? Soma, which is cell body, and dendrites, yeah. And we don't have voltage-gated channels in those areas. And because a ligand-gated channel is activated by binding a small molecule, which we call a ligand, like a neurotransmitter, right, ligand-gated channels only produce graded potentials. All right. And then we start talking about acetylcholine ligand-gated channels. Here is one of the most common kind. This is the nicotinic kind. And we can see that this is a membrane protein. It has to bind 2 molecules of acetylcholine before it goes from a closed state to an open state. And when it opens up, that depolarizes the cell. That's the nicotinic type. So, because these channels, ligand-gated channels, have to wait for a signal from another cell, like a neurotransmitter, we say that is the receiving end of a neuron. Ligand-gated channels make the receiving end of a neuron because it's got to receive a signal, it's got to receive a chemical from another cell someplace. All right, we also talked about muscarinic cholinergic channels. And when I say cholinergic, what do I mean? What do I mean when I say cholinergic? I have to ask you a question. I can't say anything because I'm trying to get my arrow working. What does cholinergic mean? Yeah, it's some kind of mechanism that uses acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter, right? So a receptor that can bind acetylcholine is a cholinergic receptor, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry. Good, thank you. Yeah, let's go to, so we can see both screens at the same time. Excellent. Okay, and so these muscarinic channels are not strictly channels that open up when acetylcholine binds to it. These are G-protein coupled receptors. And we're familiar with G-protein receptors. We talked about them before. So here is the G-protein. It's got these three subunits. Acetylcholine, in this particular case, only one binds. You don't need two. That causes dissociation of all these subunits. They can wander around on the inside of the membrane. They can bump into other proteins like this potassium channel. And if it's a potassium, sometimes it's a potassium channel that's open all the time. And if it closes, what happens? If beta and gamma close the potassium channel, what happens? That causes depolarization. Okay, because that's preventing positive charges from leaving the cell. That's keeping positive charges inside the cell. That's one way to think of depolarization. But if it opens a potassium channel, what's the effect there? If it causes sodium to leave, yeah, hyperpolarization or repolarization, that inhibits the cell, right? So if it's a potassium channel that opens, that produces either an IPSP or an EPSP. Which one do you think it will produce? If it opens, yeah, if it opens. Yeah, it's inhibitory, so it's an IPSP. But if this G protein bumps into a potassium channel and it closes, that produces an EPSP. So muscarinic ligand gated channels are a little specific to the kind of tissue that it's in. Sometimes they are excitatory, sometimes they're inhibitory. And I think you're kind of familiar with that because does anybody remember what the effect of acetylcholine is on the heart? On the heart. Heart is dually innervated. It has parasympathetic and sympathetic. Anybody remember neurotransmitters from anatomy? Maybe not. Oh, that's great. That's the reason why you took this class. All right, so we're going to get into that. All right, you know that sympathetic nervous system increases heart rate. What about parasympathetic nervous system? Decreases heart rate. Right, and the neurotransmitter of the parasympathetic nervous system is acetylcholine. Right, so the action of acetylcholine on the heart is to slow the heart rate down. Okay, and acetylcholine on skeletal muscle causes what? Contraction. Right, but that's I'm kind of comparing two different channels right there. But anyway, there's and on the heart there's an example of a muscarinic cholinergic receptor that is inhibitory. It inhibits the heart. All right, we're going to look at that in more detail when we get to the heart chapter. This is where we left off last time. Acetylcholinesterase. What can you tell me about acetylcholinesterase? It's an enzyme, yeah. And what's the substrate for acetylcholinesterase? Yeah, acetylcholine, right? It's nice modern nomenclature. This is easy. And we see that this molecule here, this protein embedded in the membrane, kind of looks like a Y. All right, what membrane is this protein embedded in? What membrane is this? Postsynaptic membrane, right? And it has an active site for acetylcholine. When acetylcholine bumps into this active site, this acetylcholinesterase breaks it down into acetate and choline. Acetate and choline does not have the right shape to bind to this G-protein coupled receptor, right? So acetate and choline cannot excite this receptor or this cell. So acetylcholinesterase then breaks down the activity of acetylcholine within the synaptic cleft. That's its job. All right, so why is acetylcholinesterase there? Because if acetylcholine were to break down, it would continuously stimulate the postsynaptic cell. Right? Even though the presynaptic cell wasn't trying to send any more information along across the synapse, right, the postsynaptic cell would still be getting information as if this presynaptic cell was sending information. Right? And so that would then would basically poison this particular synapse. Synaptic transmission would be all out of whack. So acetylcholinesterase, or anything that decreases the action of neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft, is important in resetting the synapse so that it can send information again and again and again. Right, so it resets the synapse so other kinds of information can be sent to the postsynaptic cell. All right, so let's consider this. Just kind of fun little thought. Here is the presynaptic neuron, secretes acetylcholine. It binds to this receptor that produces an action potential, say, in the axon of this postsynaptic cell. And now let's say that this acetylcholinesterase, right, is not present. So that acetylcholine stays in the synaptic cleft. And what does it do? Binds to the receptor. It constantly stimulates this cell. It constantly stimulates or excites this postsynaptic cell without a stimulus from the presynaptic neuron. What do we call it when you have a perception of something that results all by itself and not from a stimulus? Okay, so here's that presynaptic neuron not secreting anything. It's not sending a stimulus to the postsynaptic cell, but the postsynaptic cell is still being stimulated. Okay, what do we call it when you experience something without stimulation? Is a hallucination. Okay, so we definitely need acetylcholine, right, esterase, to get rid of this acetylcholine so that this synaptic transmission, okay, remains nice and healthy. That's the same for all different kinds of neurotransmitters. So let's look at a couple others. Well, we still got to finish up acetylcholine. All of these are cholinergic neurons. There's another cholinergic system, and that is for skeletal muscle. Somatic motor neuron releases acetylcholine in the neuromuscular junction. And the only kind of receptor in skeletal muscle is a nicotinic receptor. Can anybody remember what a nicotinic receptor looks like, what it does? Here it is. It's excitatory, right? Nicotinic is always going to be excitatory. So when an action potential reaches the axon terminus of a somatic motor neuron, that always causes depolarization of skeletal muscle, which causes contraction. That's all there's to it, right? That's why it's called voluntary muscle, because skeletal muscle can't produce anything, or can't do anything other than depolarize when it gets nerve stimulation. All right, so here we see, let's go back to the synapse, acetylcholine synapse. Now let's pretend, right, that, oh, I tell you what, let's just stay with this for a second. So what kind of receptors, okay, do we see on the postsynaptic cell? What kind of receptors? And here are your choices, ligand-gated or voltage-gated? Yeah, so this is a synapse between two neurons, and I only see ligand-gated channels. Okay, and the postsynaptic membrane, only ligand-gated channels on the postsynaptic neuron. I want to certainly say for sure, neuron, make sure you see this is a neuron. Now, let's change the topic a little bit and say that this is the neuromuscular junction. So the presynaptic cell is a neuron. What's the postsynaptic cell? A muscle, right. And if we were to look at the postsynaptic membrane of a muscle, you indeed would see ligand-gated channels of the nicotinic type, but interspersed between these ligand-gated channels, you would even see voltage-gated channels. So what does that mean for a muscle? As soon as acetylcholine binds to those nicotinic channels, that causes depolarization, and that directly affects those voltage-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, which produces action potential, right? So these graded potentials from ligand-gated channels and skeletal muscle don't really have to go anywhere. They're right there in the neuromuscular junction along with a voltage-gated channel. So anytime acetylcholine is in the neuromuscular junction, it's going to produce an action potential. It always has to do that because it's right in the neuromuscular junction. Okay, and because there's so many voltage-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, it produces these end plate potentials, which are very big, and that always produces muscle contraction. And curare is a poison that blocks the acetylcholine action at the neuromuscular junction, so That's one way to prevent a muscle from contraction. And the Aboriginal peoples in South America found this particular compound, right? And they would go hunting, and they could hunt with like tiny, tiny little arrows and take down huge game animals for feasting on. And that's because they would cover the tips of those arrows with this particular compound. Once entered into the game animal, then it would block the neuromuscular junction, and then what happened to that particular animal? Couldn't run away, couldn't breathe either, right? Because diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. So, particularly effective way of hunting. As long as, would you let your kids play with that bow and arrow set? No, probably not. Okay. All right. So, that was probably one of the first instances that I know of where neurotransmitters and receptors were used in an everyday sense. And right now, a lot of medicine relies on understanding something about these receptors and different chemicals that interact with these receptors. So let's talk about different kinds of neurotransmitters. There's a class called monoamine neurotransmitters. And you know something about an amino group, it's what, nitrogen, right? So here is a whole bunch that have one nitrogen. And you know any sugars that have nitrogen on them? Okay, not very many. Okay. I don't know very many lipids that have nitrogen on them. Okay, so that kind of leaves proteins, right? And what's the building block of protein? Amino acids, right? All right, so this is not like that acetyl group that you get for acetylcholine that can come from, what, fatty acids or sugar molecules. All right, these are derived from amino acids. Here's one, serotonin, derived from tryptophan. That is an amino acid. I'm not saying that serotonin is a protein, but it's derived from tryptophan. And does anybody know anything about tryptophan? Didn't cover it in this class, but it's noteworthy right now. It's in Turkey. Yeah, it's in Turkey. Okay. It is. Okay, but it is what we call an essential amino acid. And essential means that your body cannot produce it on its own. You have to receive it, right, from a dietary source, which means you have to eat tryptophan someplace. And if you don't have sufficient tryptophan in your diet, what happens? And I'm pointing to serotonin. Okay? Well, then your body can't produce serotonin, which is an important neurotransmitter. So those serotonergic pathways, right, are degraded everywhere in your body. So diet can affect synaptic transmission, right, just depending on what kind of amino acid you get. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from another essential amino acid called tyrosine. Right, and if you don't have tyrosine in your diet, then you can't make norepinephrine or dopamine, and those pathways are going to be degraded in function as well. All right, so diet can affect these different things. We're going to talk about what some of these different things do in just very shallow detail. All of these compounds are called catecholamines. Catecholamines. Unfortunately, that sounds a lot like cholinergic, but it's not. All right, and as a matter of fact, there's another compound that's related to norepinephrine. Do you know another compound that's almost has the exact same action as norepinephrine? It is epinephrine. Does anybody know another name for epinephrine? And that is adrenaline. Yeah, adrenaline. And so we use that term a lot, right, in everyday language. And so norepinephrine is the same thing as noradrenaline, but we don't really talk about noradrenaline like walking down the sidewalk. So these kind of systems that rely on epinephrine and norepinephrine are called adrenergic receptors, not cholinergic. Adrenergic, even though they use these catecholamines. Adrenergic refers to norepinephrine. All right, so here is a nice synapse. Right, and so just remember everything you've learned about a synapse before, and this is a nice chemical synapse. It's between two neurons, and I see the presynaptic, postsynaptic membrane, nice synaptic cleft. So what do all these dots represent? Yeah, neurotransmitter, a chemical neurotransmitter, and specifically norepinephrine, right? So what I wanted to get to, the point I wanted to get to was that I see these little particles here or chemicals, neurotransmitters. So what kind of synapse is this? Electrical or chemical? It's a nice chemical synapse, right? So just rely on your information that you already know about a chemical synapse, and that is the presynaptic cell has the swelling at the end, and it's loaded with vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. In this particular case, you know it to be norepinephrine because it says so right here. And again, these vesicles move over to the presynaptic membrane, and they fuse, and that exocytosis neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. When an action potential comes down the axon, and it opens voltage-gated calcium channels, right? Activates this whole cascade right here. Then neurotransmitter binds to these receptors here. And what do these receptors look like to you? Nice ligand-gated channel, right? And it's a G protein. Okay, so this particular chemical, norepinephrine, is not degraded by acetylcholinesterase. Can anybody kind of shed some light on why norepinephrine can't be broken down by acetylcholinesterase? Yeah, because it's not acetylcholine. So what's the difference between acetylcholine and norepinephrine? It is the shape. Yeah, it's the shape of those molecules. Right, so acetylcholinesterase won't break norepinephrine down because norepinephrine just doesn't have the correct shape to fit into that active site. So the postsynaptic cell doesn't even bother making acetylcholinesterase, but nonetheless, do you think it's a good idea to get rid of this norepinephrine once it's secreted? Yeah, to reset the synapse, right? Okay, so here is a couple important mechanisms. All right, and that is norepinephrine is resorbed back by the cell that it was secreted. Right, we call that reuptake. Most of the neurotransmitter, norepinephrine, is taken back up into the presynaptic cell, so then it can't bind to these ligand-gated channels anymore. That helps reset the synapse. And so we just call it, and then once it gets into the cell, it's broken down by monoamine oxidase. Right, so reuptake and monoamine oxidase are ways to get rid of this norepinephrine signal. Right, how is the chemical signal degraded in a cholinergic synapse? Acetylcholinesterase, right. For this particular one, okay, it's degraded by reuptake, or the synapse is reset by reuptake and monoamine oxidase. Yeah, question.
So once it's reuptake, it becomes an amino oxidase?
Monoamine oxidase is an enzyme that breaks norepinephrine down.
Okay. So is it being broken down back into the presynaptic cell?
It has to be taken back up by the presynaptic cell. Monoamine oxidase does not work in the synaptic cleft. It's got to be taken back up. Yeah.
It's only for norepinephrine.
Norepinephrine, monoamine oxidase, yeah, probably epinephrine.
Each one has different.
Yeah, a little bit different because the shape of these neurotransmitters is always a little bit different.
But when they release, why
do they need to be? Because norepinephrine would stay in the synaptic cleft, right? Even though the presynaptic neuron wasn't trying to send any more information, right? Norepinephrine would stay in the synaptic cleft, and it would always cause, right? It would always bind to these ligand-gated channels on the postsynaptic neuron. And then the postsynaptic neuron would be thinking, in a sense, that the presynaptic neuron is sending its signals, but it's not. Okay, so the postsynaptic cell would be receiving stimulus all the time if norepinephrine didn't go away. So what do we call that when there is a perception of something, but this presynaptic neuron is not sending any signals? If there's a perception of something without stimulus, a hallucination, right? Okay. All right, so that's pretty good. So what do these receptors look like? All right, I see a nice cell membrane. You see some proteins in the membrane right here? Indeed, you see a G protein coupled receptor. And norepinephrine binds to the receptor. That's different than the G protein per se, but it activates the G protein. Right? And after it dissociates, the alpha subunit can bump into an enzyme. that is bound to the membrane, and this enzyme is called adenylate cyclase. Right? And you've probably heard of adenosine triphosphate, same kind of word, adenylate cyclase. So adenylate cyclase uses ATP as a substrate, and I can see ATP right here, and ATP is broken down into a monophosphate. It has one phosphate, but it's a special form. It's called cyclic AMP for monophosphate, cyclic AMP. There's also just a linear form of AMP. Now, would you think that cyclic AMP would have a different function in the body compared to just the regular old linear AMP? Yeah, because when you change the shape, change the function, right? Okay, so cyclic AMP is a special kind of molecule, right? And where in this particular slide, where do you always find it? Inside the cell? And, yeah, it's inside the cell. What about norepinephrine? Where do you find that? Okay. Inside or outside the cell? Outside the cell. Oh, I see something that's outside the cell. I see something inside the cell. What is that? Remind you of first messenger, second messenger system, right? So cyclic AMP is an important second messenger. Even though the signal, norepinephrine, is trapped outside the cell, it still can induce the building of a signal inside the cell, namely cyclic AMP, right? Because adenylate cyclase has been activated. All right, adenylate cyclase, what can you tell me about it? What do you know about that just by looking at the spelling on the word? It's an enzyme, right? Because I see an ASE right here. And after adenylate cyclase catalyzes the reaction of one ATP into one cyclic AMP, what happens to adenylate cyclase? Nothing. Can it catalyze the reaction again? Yes, it can, right? It's the only thing that an enzyme does, speed up the rate of reaction, and it converts reactants into products, but it does not go away. So adenylate cyclase can convert another ATP into cyclic AMP, and it might do that thousands of times, maybe tens or 20 and hundreds of thousands of times, right? Because adenylate cyclase is not inactivated right away. So how many first messengers were required? One. How many second messengers resulted from that? But the enzyme doesn't go away. Two, three, four, thousands. Thousands, right? So here you have a tiny, tiny signal outside the cell. What's the signal like inside the cell? It's huge, right? Because you have thousands of these molecules. So what do you call it when you take a little signal and you make it bigger? Amplification, right? So here is a stage of amplification because this enzyme is not degraded. So here's one step. All right, cyclic AMP then can bind to other enzymes like a protein kinase, and it can change an inactive protein kinase and turn it into a active form. What does a kinase do once again? Adds a phosphate to something. So this protein kinase, or a number of protein kinases, can run around inside the cell phosphorylating things. Like maybe here's a channel, and maybe it jams a phosphate onto this, changes the shape, configuration of this channel, could open or close it, right? And that's going to change the membrane potential, you know, of that cell, right? Because the permeability of these ions will change, right? And so here we have that protein kinase. How many channels can it phosphorylate to change the state of? One? Two? What happens to an enzyme when it catalyzes a reaction? Nothing. It can catalyze it again. All right, so here we have, let's just say we have one protein kinase enzyme. It can not just phosphorylate one ion channel, but thousands, right? So what do you call it when you have like a little signal here and a result in a big signal? Amplification. So what do we have? We have two steps of amplification in this particular scheme, all resulting from a tiny little norepinephrine signal trapped outside the cell. So you have two steps of amplification. That is what we call a cascade mechanism, and that's what makes something happen fast, right? And this is all due to this nice second messenger system, okay? And that's going to change. That can either cause an IPSP or an EPSP, depending on what channels are being activated or inactivated. So that's pretty cool, right? You see the two levels of amplification there? If not, study this figure, and you know that to be a cascade. All right, another kind of neurotransmitter, serotonin. right, involved in regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, all kinds of different things, and maybe all different kinds of things at different times in our life. LSD is structurally similar to serotonin, so what can LSD, anybody ever hear of LSD? Probably not. And I've forgotten what LSD stands for. Okay. Yeah, but it's a hallucinogenic, okay, because it can bind to serotonin receptors, right? It's a serotonin agonist that acts like serotonin in the synaptic cleft. So even though the presynaptic cell is not sending information to the postsynaptic cell is being stimulated because LSD is there, and what does that produce? Hallucinations, that's right, okay. All right, so there are a class of drugs called serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors, right? And these are important, right, because we know that mood behavior is associated with these serotonergic pathways. These compounds can be used as antidepressants, all right? So one biological model of thinking about clinical depression is that serotonergic pathways are not functioning at their optimal or peak region. And to help boost those serotonergic pathways, right, if we block reuptake, then that enhances the effect of serotonin on the postsynaptic neuron because it's not degraded, right? And so that can overcome some of these mood changes. And here are some examples of specific reuptake inhibitors. Right. And if you block the reuptake of serotonin, right, you just prolong the action of serotonin at that synapse. Okay, so this is sort of interesting. If you take too much Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox, what would that be like doing? That would be like? Almost like taking LSD. Yeah, and if you overdose on these things, I'm sure... I don't know this for sure. Okay, this is hypothesis. That would probably produce what? Hallucinations. I don't know if these things are abused recreationally or not, but don't try. Don't tell me later, okay? Because these can actually produce changes in the brain structure as well. So I wouldn't mess with those things without the advice of a physician that knows something about that. All right, so that's norepinephrine, serotonin. Here's dopamine, another important neurotransmitter. There are two main dopaminergic systems in the brain. Okay, one has to do with motor function. That's the nigrostriatal dopaminergic system. And it's part of the basal ganglia. And degeneration of this system causes Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's disease, what does Parkinson's disease kind of look like? When somebody's moving, do they have really nice fluid motion? What is their motion like? Really staggered, right? And that's because when you contract the biceps, what else has to happen? Triceps has to relax, right? So the dopaminergic system is involved in inhibiting that tricep so that the muscle that you want to contract can contract properly. If the triceps doesn't ever relax, then you really got to fight against it to flex at your elbow. All right, so that's one particular system. Don't have time to talk about Parkinson's disease anymore, but anyway, I have to. Okay, Parkinson's disease is usually an older onset kind of disease, right? Doesn't happen to young people, but under certain circumstances it can. And that is drug abuse, okay? Because some of these drugs, mostly opiates, can bind to dopaminergic receptors and damage them, right? So sometimes people damage that motor control system in their body when they abuse drugs, unfortunately. And the other one is just brain trauma, like boxers. Who's a real famous boxer that has Parkinson's disease? Yeah, Muhammad Ali. Right, and that was just due to he didn't get hit in the head, but enough because any hit in the head from a boxer, these guys are all just super powerful hits. Right? Does anybody know of a case where somebody got Parkinson's disease at an early age? Anybody? Really famous person. Yeah, Michael J. Fox. Thank you for telling me. I always forget. Good. Michael J. Fox. That's a different disease when you forget stuff like that. Not Parkinson's. Okay. And so he got Parkinson's at a very early age, so everybody said, you must have abused drugs when you were a kid. And he said, no, I never did. And we kind of believe him. And then it was discovered that a lot of people on a TV show, okay, that he was an actor in, came down with Parkinson's disease too. And most of these were children, were early onset cases. And so then now people are thinking, well, you know, when they film TV shows and movies, they have long periods where they film and you have to stay up and you got to be really lively and awake. They figure that some producer someplace spiked the food or drinks that these actors were eating, and it had an effect on their motor system later on in life, and they ended up with Parkinson's disease. How sad. But can't be proven. Again, that is just conjecture, just hypothesis. Maybe you should look up, if you have a moment on Google, look up frozen addicts. There are a number of addicts in Great Britain, particularly got a really strange batch of synthetic heroin, and they shot up the heroin, and it poisoned the system irreversibly for the rest of their lives. All right, so they were completely normal. They could experience everything, every sensation, but they lost motor control. They were completely frozen, so they couldn't speak. They can't respond to stimulus anymore. That was a 60-minute show. I can't get a copy of it and put it on Blackboard for you, but just do a little Google search on frozen addicts. Yeah, frozen addicts. Okay, the other system, the mesolimbic dopaminergic system, involved with behavior and emotional rewards. So when it's stimulated, you have emotional reward sensations. Most addicts activate this system, right? So this is what addicts were trying to activate, and inadvertently poisoned the nigrostriatal system. Here is something that's also kind of interesting. Overactivity of the mesolimbic system produces schizophrenia, right? And one way that we think of treating schizophrenia is with anti-dopaminergic drugs. So the interesting thing I see right here is what addicts are like producing something that's akin to a schizophrenic state. Right? I have no idea why that is recreational. So definitely be careful when dealing with all these drugs. Norepinephrine. Another class of another neurotransmitter used in peripheral nervous system and central nervous system, right? In the peripheral nervous system, norepinephrine is the sympathetic neurotransmitter. We're going to get into that in the next chapter. In the CNS, norepinephrine affects general level of arousal, and amphetamines stimulate these arousal pathways in the central nervous system. All right, so you're seeing a lot of important pharmacology involved with these receptors. They're really important. And we'll talk about them in the rest of the class, I'm sure. Here are a couple other kinds of neurotransmitters. Amino acid neurotransmitters. Glutamic acid, aspartic acid are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters, which means that they produce EPSPs, right? And then here is glycine and GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. These are inhibitory neurotransmitters, right? And so glutamic acid and aspartic acid, the first two I mentioned before, are excitatory. So what's one way that you think of a neurotransmitter being excitatory? When it binds to a receptor, it causes depolarization, right? Depolarization one way or the other. Glycine, on the other hand, is going to produce... Yes, inhibitory, which produces hyperpolarization, right? That's an IPSP. How can you produce the hyperpolarization? By making the inside of the cell more negative. How can you make the inside of the cell more negative? Yeah, adding more negative to it. And what is negative outside the cell in high concentration and almost zero inside the cell? Chlorine. That's right. So glycine works by opening chloride channels. Right, and then chlorine then enters the cell, causing hyperpolarization or inhibition of those cells. Strychnine blocks the glycine receptors, and glycine is what? Excitatory or inhibitory?
Inhibitory.
So strychnine blocks that inhibitory action, right? And so then a person's nervous system just becomes hyperactive, and it's a particularly nasty poison because with any kind of stimulus, all motor pathways, right, are stimulated, and that causes muscle contraction throughout the body. And it's irreversible. So when people are poisoned with strychnine, they kind of die just like you have a big cramp all over your body. Can't breathe, right? Can't do anything. Causes spastic paralysis. Spasm, right? Spasm is when a muscle goes into contraction. Gamma-aminobutyric acid, most common neurotransmitter. That should be shocking to you because probably you would think that the most important one would be excitatory, right? But remember that the most important thing is antagonistic control, and GABA is really important in helping maintain that because it is inhibitory. And it's inhibitory because it opens chlorine channels. And these channels degenerate in another motor disease called Huntington's disease. Again, it's sort of like Parkinson's, where people have difficulty moving because they can't relax antagonistic muscles. They can't be inhibited. So they have a lot of trouble moving around. I think this is our last section in this chapter, synaptic integration. Okay, but you know what? Before I go there, I think I'm going to turn this slideshow off. And I just want to look at, oh good, it came up in the right window. Anybody recognize this thing? No? Okay, it is a cell. It is a neuron for sure, right? This is not in your textbook, but the student drew this out for you guys. A lot of information, important information on this particular slide. So let's check it out. All right, in terms of structure of this neuron, what can you tell me? I can see the three important divisions of a neuron, which are? I see the body, dendrites, and an axon over here. Yeah, and you see an arrow pointing in one direction. I saw a bunch of arrows right here, but here is the motion of an action potential, right? And you see it moving from cell body down to the axon terminus. It never goes backwards. All right, so here is the axon. And what kind of electrical event happens on an axon? Yeah, I see some myelin there. But what I'm thinking about is action potential, right? So action potentials can be propagated down an axon. And what allows an axon to propagate an action potential? Voltage-gated channels, that's right. All right, so voltage-gated channels we find on an axon, and because of that refractory period, a nerve impulse or an action potential in motion can only go from cell body down to the tip. Can't go backwards because of that refractory period. All right, let's see what else. So we got voltage-gated channels. Now, what about the dendrites? Oh, before I forget, okay, since there are voltage-gated channels, that's why we call an axon the sending end, right? It's sending information from the cell body down to the axon terminus. That's the sending end. Then we have dendrites and cell bodies. This is the receiving end. What is it receiving? Okay, it's receiving neurotransmitters or chemical signals, right? And it can respond to those chemical signals because it has a receptor. Now, what kind of receptors are those? Are they voltage-gated? They're ligand-gated, right? So they're ligand-gated receptors, and they're coupled to channels, and so that can produce iPSPs or EPSPs, right? And those are what we call graded potentials, right? So axons are action potentials. Dendrites and cell bodies produce graded potentials. How many classes of graded potentials do you know? Two, and those are? Yeah, exactly. EPSPs and iPSPs, right? So iPSPs, EPSPs are produced on dendrites and cell bodies, and so this is why we call this the receiving end of the neuron, because it has ligand-gated channels on it. Okay? And the other thing that kind of I see when I take a look at this, if you look at a real cell with a lot of dendrites, right, you see dendrites all over the place, it kind of reminds me of an antenna. Antennas we used to use by pulling TV signals out of the air, right, they were just broadcast in there, and you needed an antenna to accept these TV signals that were being transmitted to you, right, so think of dendrites as maybe antennae. Does anybody have a sense of what an antenna is anymore? Long time ago? Okay. So an antenna is what? The receiving part of your TV or your radio, right, if you have such a thing like that. Okay. All right, so the receiving end has ligand-gated channels, and it produces these graded potentials. And if we have a graded potential start over here on this dendrite, and it moves down over to the axon hillock, what happens to that signal? It degrades away, right? It propagates with degradation. It goes away, right? But there can be a number of excitations or graded potentials from each of these dendrites, and they're all going to flow into the axon hillock. And when they all flow into the axon hillock, what can happen? They can summate. So graded potentials can summate. What about action potentials? They cannot summate. What about an action potential at the axon hillock, right, and then at the axon terminus? What happens? Let's say it starts at the axon hillock and then moves all the way down to the axon terminus. What happens to it? It's exactly the same. It travels without decrement. How about if this axon grew and grew and grew and grew, and then all of a sudden these axon terminals were on the moon and the cell bodies on the Earth? What would happen to the action potential by the time it got to the moon?
Nothing.
Exactly the same signal, right? So that's pretty amazing. What else do I see on this particular slide? The receiving end, sending end, you know why? Yes. Okay, so the axon hillock is the first place where you have voltage-gated channels, right? So if all those EPSPs and IPSPs add together in the axon hillock and it reaches threshold, then what happens? Action potential, right? And so this, even the single neuron acts as a integration center and can make a decision on what to do because it has that threshold before it generates an action potential. Yeah.
So the action potential,
they
only go one way, right?
Yeah. Yeah, from axon hillock to axon terminus is the way action potential travels. Different kinds of axoplasmic flow, okay, but not electrical signals, okay? Macromolecular transport, because there's something that acts like peristalsis in an axon that can move material down to the axon terminus that is not used for signaling as far as I know, probably as far as anybody knows, okay? Okay, there's one thing on this particular slide that maybe I'll caution you about a little bit. IPSPs from muscarinic receptors, remember that's a cholinergic, but there are some muscarinic receptors that are excitatory that can produce EPSPs. All right, so you might want to just remember that. And nicotinic, what can you tell me about nicotinic? Always excitatory, that's right, always excitatory. All right, so what kind of neuron is this? Is this an adrenergic or a cholinergic neuron? Cholinergic neuron, it would be helpful maybe if you saw these particles labeled here, acetylcholine, right? Okay. All right, so action potential can only travel in one direction. What about information across the synapse? Is it one direction or bidirectional? Only one direction. Who can tell me why signals only go in one direction across the synapse? Okay, I heard something about a receptor. I like that. What about that receptor? Where do you find receptors? Oh, yes, right. So only the postsynaptic neuron has receptors. So only the postsynaptic neuron is a receiver of information. Okay. And what cell can make neurotransmitter? Only the presynaptic cell, right? So only the presynaptic cell can be the sender of information. So only one can be the receiver, the other one can be the sender. So that's why information only goes in one direction. All right, does anybody else have something favorite that they want to talk to me about, the rest of the class on this slide that I haven't mentioned so far? Is there like a little point that you'd like to make? Yeah. Yeah. A synaptic potential can have two forms. It can be an EPSP or an IPSP. It's a graded potential, right? It's a graded potential, right? Okay, axon hillock has that trigger zone because that's where those voltage-gated channels are at. I just saw that. And then don't forget the myelin sheath. What does that do? Yeah, it speeds up the rate of conduction. And if it's a myelinated axon, what kind of conduction is that? Do we call that? Yeah, saltatory versus continuous conduction. All right, so there's a lot involved with this little cell right here. Okay, another question at all? No. All right, so we're going to look at synaptic integration because we're going to be dealing with graded potentials. And remember, they can either be IPSPs or EPSPs. Well, let me see, how do I get this put away? Click there. Oh, good. Okay, go back to the slideshow. Synaptic integration. EPSPs. Well, they're graded because sometimes, right, they are small amplitude, sometimes they are large amplitude, as opposed to action potential, which are always exactly the same amplitude, right? So the graded potential is directly related to the stimulus strength. A weak stimulus will produce a weak graded potential, right? A strong stimulus will produce a strong graded potential. And it just so happens, you see, that these cause depolarization, so all of these stimuli produce EPSPs, right? So these cause depolarization. It says right here. And they have no threshold, right? If it's a very, very small stimulus, it produces a very, very small graded potential. And they can summate, right? So we can have graded potentials from each of these dendrites, and when they reach the axon hillock, they will reinforce each other, right? They will add together. And if this dendrite produces an EPSP at this location, it can produce another EPSP right afterwards. So there is no refractory period, right? So graded potentials are a lot different than action potentials. Sorry, I got to get my cursor back. Okay. All right, and so now we see this is the receiving end, right, of that neuron right there. And if EPSPs summate and reach threshold at the axon hillock, what does that produce? Action potential, right? All right, so that is an example of spatial summation, right? But here it is shown a little bit better. So here I see the postsynaptic neuron. We see one postsynaptic neuron, and I see two presynaptic neurons. Presynaptic will send information to the postsynaptic cell. And I see two circumstances. I see two arrows down below, the first one and the second one. Let's talk about the first one first. This first arrow, okay, is a signal from the number one presynaptic neuron. And it produces what kind of signal in the postsynaptic neuron? If I just look at this voltage trace right here. An EPSP, it causes depolarization, right? And you can see it's a sub-threshold stimulus. It's depolarization, but it's sub-threshold. So by the time it reaches the axon hillock, no action potential will ensue. All right, so that's one case. Second case. Right, we have these two presynaptic neurons. They send action potentials down to the axon terminus. Right, and both of these produce EPSPs way out here on these dendrites. By the time these two EPSPs reach the axon hillock, right, they arrive closely at the same time, but from two different locations. Now they can add together to reach threshold. That can produce a threshold stimulus, right, and then action potential goes on its way. So if you have EPSPs produced at two different locations, we call that spatial summation at the axon hillock, or within this trigger zone, okay, at the same time. There can also be temporal summation, and we almost sort of see that, okay, on this slide right here. Okay, these two EPSPs are not exactly, all right, at the same time, but if you have a graded potential at two different locations, and if they arrive at the exact same time or close in the same time before the first graded potential dies away, right, it can affect the first one. We call that temporal summation. Okay. Here are two ways that a postsynaptic cell can be inhibited, right? And that is with an IPSP, right? Some kind of inhibitory neurotransmitter. Ooh, how is an inhibitory neurotransmitter going to act? What's it going to do? It's going to hyperpolarize the postsynaptic cell. Can you tell me one of your favorite ways we can hyperpolarize that membrane? Potassium channel. Doing what to it? Opening a potassium channel, right. Letting a positive charge leave the cell, or open a chloride channel, let a negative charge enter the cell. Either way works, is fine. Okay. Let's talk about postsynaptic inhibition. Where are we going to start thinking about postsynaptic inhibition? On the presynaptic cell or postsynaptic cell? Yeah, postsynaptic cell, that's how it got its name, right? So remember, GABA and glycine both produce iPSPs. These iPSPs can summate with ePSPs and cancel each other out. And that's what this slide shows. So if the first cell is an inhibitory cell releasing GABA or glycine, that's going to produce an iPSP that hyperpolarizes the postsynaptic cell. Okay. Cell number two, right, let's just say is a norepinephrine, maybe an adrenergic neuron or a cholinergic neuron that's going to produce an ePSP or excitatory or depolarization on a dendrite on the same postsynaptic cell. Right. If both one and two act together, okay, what does that do? That cancels out the excitatory signal from number two neuron, number two presynaptic cell. So the iPSP, right, inhibits the ability of this ePSP to reach threshold, right? If this ESP by itself happened without this iPSP, what would happen if cell number two sent signals to the postsynaptic cell? Where would it start? It would start at resting membrane potential, and then it would grow to the same amplitude, but then what would happen? It would reach threshold, right, and then an action potential would ensue. So again, this cell, the postsynaptic cell, just integrating information from all over the place, both excitatory and inhibitory, to decide whether it's going to allow an action potential to move down to the axon terminus. Unlike a somatic motor neuron, right? Somatic motor neuron only has nicotinic channels. Only depolarization happens at the neuromuscular junction. So a skeletal muscle can never decide by itself if it wants to contract or not. It just always does what it's told, which is depolarize and contract. All right, last slide, synaptic inhibition. All right, so I see one postsynaptic cell in gold, and I see three other cells, other neurons, and looks like red to me. These are the presynaptic neurons. Right, do you see kind of red? Oh, there's one over here too. Right, so I see some terminal buttons on the cell body. Anybody know what kind of synapse this is called? It's on an axon terminus going to a cell body. We call this an axosomatic synapse, axosomatic because it synapses on the soma of this neuron. All right, so axosomatic. Here is another terminal button on a dendrite. We want to call this what kind of synapse? Axodendritic. Yeah, axodendritic. So we've got axosomatic, axodendritic. Does anybody see another kind? This is a weird kind. This is a weird kind. I haven't mentioned these before. As a matter of fact, I maybe even told you that this never happens. But here's an example. Right, there's always an exception to the rule. Here's a synapse, not on the postsynaptic cell, but on another presynaptic cell. And what part of the presynaptic cell is going to receive information from this other presynaptic cell? There's an axon. So what kind of synapse is this? Can't be axosomatic, can't be axodendritic. It is axoaxonic, right? So here's an axoaxonic synapse. And in this particular case, right, this middle neuron at this axoaxonic synapse is going to produce inhibition. So what is that, iPSP or EPSP? iPSP. So this can cause, right, hyperpolarization. As a matter of fact, it can cause so much hyperpolarization that it can block the transmission of an action potential. Right, so that graded potential here can influence that action potential so that this region of the axon can't ever reach threshold. And so even though the presynaptic neuron is trying to send a signal, this neuron over here blocks it. So that is pretty interesting. All right, so here is an axon causing presynaptic inhibition, right, because it's before the synapse. These over here are producing iPSPs, but they're on the postsynaptic cell, so we call this postsynaptic inhibition because it happens on the postsynaptic cell. Inhibition is happening on the presynaptic cell here, so we call it something a little bit different. All right, so we do have some marvelous nervous tissue that can make all these kinds of decisions for us. I better bring this slide back if you have a question about it. Okay, what's your question?
My question is, what happened on 1 neutron or 2 neutron?
Okay, I see a neuron right here. Are you speaking about this one?
No, I mean this happened to. No, this happened on 1 neutron or when 2 neutrons connect together.
Only with a synapse. It has to be a synapse. Okay, and a synapse is communication between at least two cells. Okay. But in this case, I see more than two cells, right? I see 1, 2, 3, 4 different presynaptic cells. And all of that information from all those presynaptic cells can add up on the postsynaptic cell because they all start what? Graded potentials. Graded potentials on the postsynaptic cell. Okay, see me after class if I didn't understand your question just right. But I think we got pretty close to it. All right, so what is next before the test? So you think it might be a good idea to just kind of carry on a little bit? Yeah, that's probably a good idea. We've got a couple minutes left, right? So the sooner we go over this stuff, the better. Okay, where did these slides come from? You only have two?
Well, there's one that's two and one
that's. Oh, good. Okay. I'm certainly confused. All right, let's start with these because I got these two. I guess I made these up. Actions of the autonomic nervous system, right? Part of autonomic nervous system is brain and spinal cord, right? Central part is peripheral. Mostly we think of it as being in the periphery. All right, and how many divisions are there in the autonomic nervous system?
Two.
And their action, what's the relationship between these two? Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other. Gas, brake pedal, so you know how important that is. Right. So if they are antagonistic to each other, and this is usually the case, here is a good example. Sympathetic causes pupil dilation. Parasympathetic will cause pupil, constriction, contraction, right? Okay, so antagonistic effects. That's usually the case. Most organs are dually innervated. Some are not. We'll look at some examples of which are not dually innervated. Besides working antagonistically, oh, I know why I put this slide together. Sometimes they are complementary to each other. They produce similar effects. They're not just purely antagonistic. So let's compare sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic causes the secretion of thick, viscous saliva. So it causes the secretion of saliva, right? The parasympathetic causes increased secretion of saliva as well. Right, just a different kind, a little bit watery, right? But they both produce saliva, depending on what we need saliva for. And we're going to get into the digestive system. That is complementary when the effects are similar. All right. Then the third way that these nervous systems can interact is in a cooperative way, right? And that means that it produces two different effects, right? But these two effects function together, produce something together. All right, and a really good example of this, sympathetic causes ejaculation in the male sex act, and parasympathetic doesn't cause ejaculation, it causes erection. Right, so if everything is operating properly to good cause, right, you should have both of these working together, right, to maintain the species. All right, so we got these three classes, antagonistic, complementary, cooperative, antagonistic. I can't really say this, but antagonist is more prevalent. I want to say the most important, but that's probably not true, right? Because we need what those cooperative ones as well. Some examples of single innervation, right? And it is by the sympathetic nervous system. The adrenal medulla only receives sympathetic adrenergic neurons, right? And this is strange. In the heart, the ventricles only receive sympathetic information, not parasympathetic, right? So the ventricles can only be excited. They can't be inhibited. And you'll learn what these different things mean when we get to the heart. It has a positive inotropic effect. Positive means it excites the force of contraction. Inotropic means force of contraction. Blood vessels. Mostly singly innervated, it's excitatory, causes vasoconstriction. And we got to finish the class before you really understand what the effects are in the body of all these things. Erector pili, right? Excitatory, cause contraction, which produces, goosebumps, right? And sweat glands, singly innervated by sympathetic nervous system, excitatory, which causes the secretion, right, from these different glands. And you know a number of different kinds of glands. All right, so sorry, I didn't know that I had two different sets. Which one did I open? I wonder. What is this? 9 autonomic nervous additions. Oh, okay. I do have it labeled. Okay, tell me what chapter I want to be looking for. 9?
Yeah.
Without additions. Probably this one right here. Right on. Okay. Let's see what we got here. I didn't think we're going to get through that chapter 7 today. So, let's see what I can remember about the autonomic nervous system without preparation. Okay, introduction, that should be easy. Neurons, divisions, all that stuff. Okay. All right, so the autonomic nervous system manages our physiology without our conscious control. And so you got millions of things happening inside your body. You don't have to think about everything that's going on. You don't have to think about urine production. You don't have to think about digestion, maintaining body temperature, electrolyte balance, all that kind of stuff, right? It's regulated by the autonomic nervous system. And what are the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system? Let's kind of get this straight. I got like 3 kinds of effector organs. Okay, before we get to the effector organs, what does an effector organ do? An effector organ, this goes like back to the very first day of class. As a matter of fact, it goes back before class even started when I sent you a picture to be able to draw out. What does an effector, always produces a response. That's it, right. Okay, so effector organ always produces a response. So what are the 3 main effector organs that can produce a response in our body? The autonomic nervous system goes to 2 of these. Okay, adrenal gland is important. Okay, it is a gland. So autonomic nervous system does go to glands. So glands is an important class of effector organs. Okay. And smooth muscle, right? You don't have voluntary control of smooth muscle. So autonomic nervous system goes to smooth muscle, glands, and I suppose you could put heart muscle in there as well, but smooth muscle and glands. Where does the somatic nervous system go? What's the effector organ for the somatic? Skeletal muscle, right? So autonomic is like one system in your body, somatic is another, somatic is voluntary, going to skeletal muscle, effector organs. Autonomic nervous system goes to glands, smooth muscles, right, as the effector organs producing those respective responses. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. It just has a tonic contraction ability. Some actually can contract in a rhythmic fashion, can contract and relax, which then kind of reminds me of the heart a little bit when we get to the heart. Smooth muscle becomes more sensitive when the innervation is cut off. So glands become hypersensitive. Smooth muscle becomes hypersensitive when it loses innervation. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. All right, so for instance, autonomic nerves that go to the urinary bladder, if they're cut, what happens to urinary bladder, smooth muscle? Hyperexcited, yeah, it wants to stay contracted, right? So urinary bladder can't relax, can't fill up with urine. Many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active. The autonomic nervous system just adjusts the rate of that rhythmicity, right? It just increases or decreases the rate. All right, so here is, a nice comparison between a somatic outflow pathway and an autonomic outflow pathway. Somatic is on the top. The effector organ is for somatic is a skeletal muscle. Yeah, it's voluntary. How many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system all the way to the effector organ? Can you see it well enough? Just 1. This is true. All right, somatic outflow pathway, the motor neuron is just 1. And then down on the bottom, we see a nice outflow pathway for, in particular, can you tell if this is parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system? If you guys reviewed autonomic nervous system, you'd be able to tell. Okay, it is sympathetic because it's coming from the spinal cord. Remember, sympathetic is thoracolumbar outflow. So here is the cell body of one of the motor neurons. It leaves, this is called a root. Remember a root? Okay, now what root is it? I see two. Which root is this? Yeah, it's a ventral root. Ventral root is 100% motor, right? It only has the cell bodies in the central nervous system. Axons are leaving. And then, okay, and then I see it going into the ventral ramus and then into this auxiliary spinal cord. But it's only for sympathetic activity. This is called the sympathetic chain. And these little nodes right here are ganglia. Can anybody define a ganglion for me? What's a ganglion? Yeah, it's a group of nerve cell bodies where? In the peripheral nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system? A nucleus, yeah. So here's a whole bunch of them here, peripheral nervous system, so this is a ganglia. All right, and they're connected together, different levels of the spinal cord, so this is what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia, so this is for sympathetic outflow. I see the sympathetic nerve entering via your physiology book gets this wrong. This is the, gray or white ramus? Oh man, I forgot. It's either the gray or white, and I'll be able to tell you because I know the book has it wrong, right? This is a ramus communicantes. And then here is the second neuron. And since this happens after the ganglia, we call this the postganglionic neuron. The one that brings information into the ganglion is the preganglionic neuron. Right? And whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, there are two neurons, the preganglionic and postganglionic. And you're going to have to just remember which one is myelinated and not myelinated. Okay, the preganglionic is not myelinated, if I remember correctly. So the ramus that it enters is the gray ramus communicans, if it's a non-myelinated fiber. All right, so we got these two fibers. One is pre, one is post. All right, and so the postganglionic takes that sympathetic outflow to the effector organ. And in this particular case, well, you can't tell. It's smooth muscle, but there could be glands in there as well. Okay. Okay, divisions. Oh, this is good. I'll be able to stop after talking about this slide. All right, so we got two divisions, sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship usually between these two divisions? Antagonistic, but there are some exceptions to that rule. All right, and there are some ways that we can think of these two different divisions. Right, if you're really good at memorizing, you can memorize the effects of parasympathetic on every organ and gland in your body. Right, and the same thing for the other one, but there might be an easier way of doing that, and that is just to characterize what the sympathetic nervous system does so that when it goes someplace, you get a sense of what it should be doing, right? And the same thing for parasympathetic. So the sympathetic, we're going to characterize it as the fight, flight, and stress nervous system, right? So when you're in a stressful situation, which nervous system is activated? Sympathetic, not parasympathetic. All right, when you're presented with a life-threatening situation, which nervous system is activated to deal with that life-threatening situation? Sympathetic nervous system, right? So anytime you have an organ, you want to think, well, what is it, what's going to happen to it? Is it going to be activated in a time of stress or fight or flight, or is it going to be inhibited under those circumstances? If it's inhibited, it's parasympathetic. If it's activated, it's sympathetic. All right, so how do we want to consider the parasympathetic nervous system? Rest and digest, right? So when you're resting, okay, that is under the control of the parasympathetic nervous system and also digestion. So is parasympathetic nervous system excitatory or inhibitory on the digestive processes? Okay, it is excitatory because that's what we mean by this statement, rest and digest, all right? So if the parasympathetic is excitatory on the digestive system, what about sympathetic? Inhibitory. That's going to be opposite that. So You can't really say for sure what the sympathetic, parasympathetic does. You just know that they are antagonistic to each other. And these two little sayings gives you a sense of what would happen in your body. Okay, so I'm almost done with this, but I want to give you maybe a way to start thinking about some of these things. All right, so some of you have to go to work tonight, I'm sure. And where should you be working? I don't know. Maybe a store that rents out DVDs or tapes, right? If there's still a store like that anymore. So let's just say that you're there. Okay, so you're working at the store. The store owner still owns the store. Now, how are you when you're working at this particular store? Well, you got a lot of time on your hands, right? Because nobody's going in there. So you got all this time on you. You don't have to work very hard. What nervous system is activated when everything is just like you hardly have to do anything? You're resting, parasympathetic nervous system, right? So you realize, oh, gee whiz, you know, since I have all this extra time, I'm going to look at some exam figures, okay? I'm going to look at some questions at the end of the chapter, all right? So now you're getting paid, right? You're not working very hard, and you're getting and you're preparing yourself really well for the test. What nervous system is activated? Everything's in control, right? So it's the parasympathetic nervous system, right? Yeah, unless you're stressed, but you're preparing for that exam, right? So that stress level is going down, that's parasympathetic nervous system. All right. But I'm not quite done. I gotta finish this before you go, so you guys don't make too much noise. We'll get out of here pretty soon. All right, so it's time to close the shop, and you're done working. What nervous system is activated now? Parasympathetic, parasympathetic, because everything's still in control, and you look at the cash register, and all the receipts match up with the expenditures, so you don't have to put $20 into the cash register. What nervous system's working? Parasympathetic, everything is great, right? So you got all your belongings, and you start to walk out of the store, and then all of a sudden, all the lights in the neighborhood go black, all right? You can't see anything. I mean, it goes dark. You can't see anything. So what about that parasympathetic nervous system now? Kind of cools off a little bit. What nervous system becomes activated a little bit now? Sympathetic, right? Because you can't see what's happening, so you step outside, lock the door, and then you realize, oh, the parking lot was full when you got to work. You had to park like two blocks away, way out in the neighborhood someplace. So now what nervous system is being activated? Sympathetic, right? So what is happening? Your heart rate increases. You might start to perspire. What about pupil? Is it constricted or dilated? They're starting to dilate so they can perceive threats that might be coming, right? All right, so you go, all right, well, I want to go home. So you start walking to your car, right? And maybe about a block away before you get to your car, you hear footsteps behind you, and they're getting closer. What nervous system now is activated? Sympathetic nervous system. Okay, under those circumstances, is your body interested in digesting food or having blood go to your heart and skeletal muscle? Heart and skeletal muscle. What about your pupils? Yeah, dilated, right? Okay, so increased heart rate, sympathetic nervous system. All right, you get to your car. You put your key in the door. You click your little clicker to open the door. And then all of a sudden you hear my voice saying, oh, what are you doing out here so late at night? Now what nervous system is activated? No, you're parasympathetic, right? Because now you're relaxed and a nice familiar voice, right? Somebody that's going to be on your side no matter what. All right, so now your parasympathetic nervous system is active. What happens to your heart rate? Starts to go down, you stop sweating, right? Your pupil goes back to its normal diameter, okay? So that's how you should think of these different effects, sympathetic and parasympathetic, on things all over your body. Which one is going to help you fight? Which one is going to help you relax, right? Rest and digest versus fight and flight. Okay. So when we come back, here's some anatomy. Make sure you know this anatomy because we're going to get through some of the physiology pretty quickly after that, right? So look at your anatomy of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, that's it. Sign-in sheet was going around, and I'll turn some lights on.